Live on DAZN Worldwide, May 2nd and 3rd, Garcia versus Romero and Canelo versus Skull. Friday from 6 p.m. Eastern, Garcia returns in a history-making Times Square takeover. 24 hours later, Saturday from 7 p.m. Eastern, King Canelo faces undefeated Skull for the undisputed crown. May 2nd and 3rd, a knockout weekend of boxing. Pick one or go all in for only $90, exclusively on DAZN. Buy now at DAZN.com/boxing.
When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
All right. Welcome to the end of the world. Welcome back to Friends from Work, a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, hosted by me, Kyle Sconewill, and my friend, Robbie Earle. But if you're listening to this, it means you are a subscriber to Friends from Work Plus, and so you already know all of that. We've been on a journey going through the entire Fox universe, specifically at this point, the X-Men universe from the early 2000s and now mid-2000s. And last week, we officially had a lot of the X-Men timeline reset with Days of Future Past. And so in a lot of ways, X-Men Apocalypse is the first new entry into what this Days of Future Past, Logan's actions, what it looks like now. Mm-hmm. In this new universe, where really only First Class is the film that has kind of, in a way, happened now outside of some memories.
Yeah.
And so, Robbie, this is an interesting film because we have been kind of teasing this one for a while, just in that we have now hit the threshold where these films are truly new to both of us, including, I think, next time with Dark Phoenix, a film that truly we both have not seen it all.
Right.
So welcome to Oscar Isaac and X-Men Apocalypse, Rob.
Man, I had not, I've said this, I think I've seen a lot of this and like most of the scenes seemed vaguely familiar, but I really, like this was essentially a first watch for me, especially in the context of this ongoing journey. And I do think, like, you know, looking back at the time when this came out, we've always talked about kind of what was going on in other superhero worlds. This was 2016, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so, you know, it's interesting again to see, you know, in 2014, Days of Future Past comes out, is very well received, both critically and commercially. And so the fact that it's coming out the year, like we talked about what a crazy year that was, but still Days of Future Past, even if it didn't get the kind of platform it would have gotten in a less busy year, I think still stood out as kind of the pinnacle of the franchise potentially. And it's interesting how much happens in 2 years, not even talking about the quality of this movie, just talking about the landscape, because then you kind of fast forward. And in 2016, you have Civil War, you have Doctor Strange, and then on the other hand, you have Batman versus Superman. And things, it starts to really clarify the differences between the MCU properties and the other superhero properties that I think, like, the end of the 2010s was when that contrast was the sharpest. And I think this is mm-hmm. when that really comes into focus here. And that's, again, not even talking about the quality as much as talking about, like, the cultural investment in it. Because mm-hmm. I remember being pretty excited to go see Days of Future Past. I remember being pretty excited to even go see The Wolverine in theaters. Like, I was still enough invested. But by the time this came out, it's crazy to me whenever I look back at, like, pretty big Marvel properties that I just didn't even feel the need to go to the theaters to see. And this was certainly that for me. Like, that's how little I cared what was going on in X-Men World by 2016.
Right.
And that is kind of wild.
That was essentially going to be my opening thought as well. This is a really strange movie and episode, isn't it?
Yeah.
This is a strange one.
I was thinking I that think too.
On so many levels. And you just pointed out maybe the most important level, the stark contrast between these franchises culturally. I'm totally with you. Whether it's because of the other films coming out from rival companies, or whether it was because subconsciously there's a little bit of a weirdness with the Days of Future Past reset. Like, meaning, did you unintentionally lose the few people that were still invested in that you're making now a new film kind of without the track record now a little bit?
Right.
It's so weird, Robbie, because I don't think it's that terrible. It's not a train wreck of a movie. It's just so strange. It's strange that it's invisible culturally.
Yeah.
It's like some of the calls are so strange. It's just a really weird episode today to me. I don't want to take the approach of really making fun of it because I still enjoyed my time. It's not horrifically bad, but there's still some strange stuff. I don't know, man. This was one of the weirdest, maybe most difficult episodes for me to record in a while. I actually have a full page of notes. So it's not that I didn't have thoughts. I just left feeling like, wow, this is weird that this movie exists. And by the way, it's fascinating that it's Bryan Singer and John Ottman kind of running it back.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
It feels like they ran it back to no success. Like they ran it back and it totally got lost. So like any like goodwill that he had earned by coming in and resetting things with Days of Future Past, this just feels so irrelevant now. In so many ways, doesn't it?
Yeah. And you know, it's like I was thinking about how we ended our Days of Future Past episode. And, you know, my theory has always been that if we were not doing this rewatch to get ready for Deadpool and Wolverine, I would treat the Deadpool movies as basically just operating in kind of their own universe. And I would treat Logan as kind of operating in its own universe. And I would let Days of Future Past be the end of the X-Men franchise. And what I didn't realize is that from Singer's perspective and Simon Kinberg's perspective, who wrote on this and Days of Future Past, I believe, this was supposed to be the end of a trilogy that started with First Class. That was at least the way that they were viewing it. I think that that is where the core disconnect comes in between how audiences viewed this and how they viewed this. Because Days of Future Past, it's just so strange. It feels like we talked about the Endgame comparisons. Like, it feels so much like that should have been the moment when Singer walks away, right? Like, he finally has his time to come back and gets to undo the damage that he thought that filmmakers after him had done to his legacy within that franchise. And it feels like a really satisfying tying up of a lot of loose ends and kind of the most that film has ever felt or that franchise has ever felt like it's being left in a satisfying place. And granted, you know, there is the stinger for Apocalypse in the credits of Days of Future Past. So even then, you know that there's like an opening, whereas, you know, like Endgame famously doesn't have any of those to kind of give it that sense of finality. And I will also say this movie, again, for being the, you know, the final installment in a trilogy, according to the makers, then sets up yet another film after that with like the Essex post-credit scene. And it's just it's a weird film to me, primarily from like a framing perspective, because if you followed up Endgame with like just an immediate next Avengers movie, like 2 years later, that just picks up where Endgame left off and then just kind of.
Not only that, though, no reflection on Endgame, and some things would be reset to where Endgame doesn't even matter really as much. It's even worse than just doing another Avengers movie right away.
Right, right. No, and I think that's like that's the other interesting thing here. Like, they're viewing this as the end of a trilogy, I guess. And so I thought of that because you're talking about running it back. Like, they obviously pull the exact final scene between Charles and Xavier in the very first X-Men movie and put it here as the last scene between them in this movie. And so it's like, you know, there are some moments there where I'm like, okay, I see that. I see that this is Stinger's last kind of stamp. And there's something kind of moving about that in terms of what they're trying to accomplish and how far they've come. But it's also like that should have been done in Days of Future Past. Like that, like, why are we doing that stuff here? And it's also like, why are we, like, if that's the goal, to bring it full circle and to make it feel like we're now kind of more or less where we left off with the relationships, or kind of more or less where we start with the relationships between these characters in the first X-Men film, even though it's a different timeline. Like, it's weird that then in this movie, to kind of get into the plot things, and then I'll shut up for a second, but the, like, using Apocalypse, who,
yeah.
It's the first time in this entire franchise that we've ever had something that's that kind of fantasy-esque. And so it's such a weird final note to end on. Like, the thing about Days of Future Past is it all makes sense because this is the final, like, this is the thing that Magneto's been warning Xavier about forever, and the thing that Xavier has been trying to fight against in his own way forever, and it comes to fruition in mutants being hunted, and that all makes sense.
And isn't there a little part of you when you're watching this film that goes, man, Logan did all of that to save them from what happened in Days of Future Past only to have this happen? Like, is this way better? This is not way better for a while. You know, it's another world-ending threat. So, okay, I'm glad you dove in, because what you kicked us off with the movie just feeling so peripheral and not needed and not necessary and so weird as a follow-up to Days of Future Past. I have two other major question marks about the whole thing. And again, I actually enjoyed my watch, and there's some stuff that's kind of fun and I can compliment.
Yeah.
But my other two major, like, I just don't get it. One, and we talk about the power levels, and I feel like it becomes like a joke for me where it's like, Kyle's the power levels guy. This is what I mean. Like, this is the example of when it just doesn't work. It'd be the equivalent of the way the MCU for 5 years built up to Thanos, and for 8 years built up to these Infinity Stones, and making that the end all be all. The equivalent would then be putting out an Avengers movie a year later or 2 years later that has an even larger threat. Now it's there's actually a guy behind all of that that's worse than Thanos. Which is why we respected so much that the MCU, you know, in our rewatch order, had those three projects that are more reflecting. There aren't any kind of threats of sorts. It's more just kind of reflecting on what happened in that film. And here, to go back further after the Sentinels, like, we had the Sentinels, we just saw that's the worst thing that could happen to the X-Men. To then go back to ancient Egypt and say there's actually an original mutant who's a god that can do even worse things.
Right.
It just immediately makes me start feeling like, what is the point of Days of Future Past, like, preventing that from happening? It also just starts getting, and this is what the MCU is so good at, Robbie, and DC and Sony and Fox just didn't learn ever. It gets so hard to get your mind around the power levels of what's happening when he can just touch people or, like, just change his eyes and they just disintegrate. Like, there's so, Robbie, I think this is a major thing. I'm downplaying it, but, like, how can you get into a movie where that's the level of power, having followed Days of Future Past, which just told us that was the worst thing that could ever happen. Now we're seeing a worst thing that could happen, and the battles become Magneto pulling metal from all of Earth and destroying every city, and they take all of the nuclear missiles to the sky. And then, Robbie, this is my kicker, showing us that there's no way to stop it except for one character who decides to finally get involved at the end. That's the trump card. Like, do you realize how lazy of storytelling that is in power levels? Like, what in, when you have a character like Apocalypse, what in the world is the point of having a character like Angel? It just doesn't make sense. It's like,
oh yeah, yeah.
Like, so like when you have Apocalypse, it ruins the other characters because it's too large. It's too large. It would be like putting Hawkeye face to face with Thanos at the end and telling him to shoot arrows at him. There's just no point in doing that. It becomes so ungrounded. It's such a mess. And then I just don't understand why these comic book movie makers, Robbie, seemingly lean into that. Like, how is that cool for anybody? It feels like Batman versus Superman to me, where I'm like, why is it cool that there's another person that can just blast them through a larger skyscraper? How is that even more fun to watch? I'd rather watch the Black Widow fights hand to hand. That's what I'd rather watch. Because at least my brain can get on board with it. And then here's my final thought on that.
I mean, I'd rather watch Michael Keaton's eyes in the rearview mirror of a car.
Don't you, if we're talking about tension, don't you feel more tension there? You feel more tension there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And here's my final kicker about the whole thing, this whole power levels thing. You know, the movie ends on the streaming service. I think it was on Disney Plus, right? Yeah. And so, you know, places the credits. I watched the post-credit sequence. And then you know how it like minimizes the screen and pulls open, you would also like this film if you watch this. The one tagline it pulls open is, the next movie you need to watch is Dark Phoenix. And the tagline says, the X-Men face an even larger threat.
Right.
And I'm like, what the literal F? Like, how is that cool? It's so lost on me, dude. I don't get it. Sorry. End of rant.
No, I think that's exactly right. And that's why I think Thanos was handled so well. And it's even why I think scenes like his fight on Titan, even the first part of Infinity War, when like he beats the Hulk, and that's such a pivotal moment, but the Hulk still kind of knocks him over.
It's hand to hand, and they're actually just punching each other. They're not.
And when Tony does get like a drop of blood, that's such a perfect scene, because it both shows how hopeless it is, but it also shows that he can in fact be hurt. And there's a physicality to it. Like, I like that Thanos' power, like the Infinity Stones are different because you understand that it's like a MacGuffin, and it's a thing that he's got that can be taken away. It's not like Thanos is himself capable of altering the state of reality.
Right, but they also establish that. I'm fine with there being an ultimate power once you establish it. So you establish it of sorts in Days of Future Past, only then to say, here's this guy actually that's been the Infinity Stones from 2014 on, they kind of set up like, okay, these cannot be topped. And I'm okay with that then. If everything then falls below that, you know?
No, I think part of what makes Apocalypse such a tough villain, the way that they have represented him, is just any time you have a character whose power set, you know, and talking, whether we're talking power levels or just, to me, it's more of like a power mechanics thing. Like, and you brought this up really early on in our original rewatch with Loki. And I think it's okay with Loki because he's the trickster god. It's like, it's not as though Loki is doing anything with his magic that is like so seismically impactful that it's like going to be a like crucial plot point. Like, even in the Battle of New York, most of what Loki's doing is powered by the Infinity Stones, or he's just kind of fighting, or doing like a fake out illusion. But like when you have a magic-y character, and I know that Apocalypse is a mutant, although even in the comics he is kind of a sorcerer also. It's so weird how comics eventually have to make all of these people like multiple things. But he is just this like guy that thinks things and then they happen. And when that's the case, it's just like I don't think that anyone else matters ever, unless there's someone like Xavier that can get into his head. And they do a good job of showing, you know, the showdown between him and Charles. And I do think, you know, for how significant Jean Grey as Phoenix is supposed to be, and for how much that was botched throughout the series and will be next film, there, I did think that there was something of a kind of like cheer moment, you know, whenever Charles has been telling Jean how to control her powers, and he, like, the moment where she can let go is the moment when she's needed, and like there's a level of confidence that she had to build. Like, it wasn't just that she was sitting it out intentionally, like she's a kid. And so like I thought that was all cool, but to your point, everything else that's happening around that just feels so unnecessary to me. Even the Magneto thing, like,
right, so in hindsight, all they needed to do was prep Jean. That would have been the only plan.
Although, but the in fairness to them, it's not as though they all right. had, like, Xavier was gone, so he wasn't able to like help them figure out a plan, and nobody else would really have.
And they didn't
that
know
kind of
it
insight.
Was going to come to that, you know.
Right. But I do, like, I think even Magneto like destroying, you know, the Sydney Opera House and everything across the planet, like, I don't get why that's necessary, because as soon as Apocalypse gets Charles's power, he controls everyone anyway. Why does he need to destroy everything? Like, what's the benefit of that? He can still take over the world, and now he gets to take over a world that isn't trashed.
Right.
There were several moments like that in this movie for me, actually. Like, I also felt the same way about why did they have to destroy Cerebro in that one scene? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Like, because they were too attached.
Well, but what's weird is like Apocalypse was already like he had already done everything, and that was like it wasn't it was I thought it was building to this like, oh, okay, he's like almost gonna do it. Apocalypse is almost gonna do it, and then they're gonna destroy Cerebro just in the nick of time, and then he can't. But he launches all the nukes. He does like what he's trying to do. And then they like, you know, explode all of Cerebro as though it's this like, oh man, like, good thing.
Well, I think Charles thought that he needed Cerebro for that part of his strength. But then the big reveal is that Apocalypse is saying, Charles, you're even stronger than you know. Like, you could be doing this without Cerebro. And I don't think Charles knew that legitimately. So I think when he said destroy it, he thought that would put an end to how many people Apocalypse could control at once, only then to learn that, oh, I am capable of this, and therefore he's capable of this.
That's fair. But then right after that, though, like, the Havoc death scene is also like, feels unnecessary to me, because it's like he just like tries to hit Apocalypse, and Apocalypse like uses the portal right. that he came there with to leave. So that shouldn't be a surprise that he has access to that.
And then it blows up the entire mansion because
he hits a gas line. Like, it's not even like okay, I'm going to sacrifice myself for everybody. It's just like a mistake. It's just a strange. There are several things in this movie like that where I'm like, I'm not saying that it's a plot hole. It just doesn't feel. Like, we talk about some, like, certain movies where every scene feels both, like, additive and integral. So it's like you're somehow, it's like the economy of storytelling thing. Like, you're using this scene to get across, like, two or three different ideas. You're establishing this relationship and you're moving the plot forward. And that's when something feels, like, so finely tuned that it's like you get something like Infinity War. And so much of this movie was not bad. Like, there are very few things, right, to exactly. your point, that I was like upset about, but there was so much fat to be trimmed, I thought.
Well, and just questions. That's what I mean. Yeah. Not horrible, but like, really? That's what we're doing? One little epilogue to the power levels thing. Then I want to share my final question mark / concern. And then I have some positives. Here's one other example for me. This version of Quicksilver rules, right? Am I crazy? I think that he's a highlight in two of the films he's in.
Yeah. This version. I think Evan Peters is great here. And
I think they've given this character more depth and coolness than the MCU version. This would be like the one character where I'd say, yeah, this is probably a better interpretation. Okay. Yeah. So I like it. It's a highlight. I wrote that down. That being said, my brain has a little bit of a hard time with even the specifics of how they're portraying the speed running thing. Like, when it's as fast as they go here, to where literally time stands still, like he can clear an entire mansion, listen to a song, move people's bullets all in the course of one explosion. I feel like it's another example of, we get some really cool, fun scenes. Okay. So don't hear me say that. Like, my wife likes it and I agree, but it's also a little bit hard for me to get my mind around, well, how would he ever be stopped? Like, why isn't that the ultimate trump card if he's that fast? Like, that's the one aspect of the MCU with like Makari and Quicksilver in the MCU where I'm like, okay, he was fast, but he can get caught, you know? It's not so fast that he can stand still and do whatever he wants during it. And that's just an example of like, I understand the fun positives of it, but it just seems like it's one step too far to where I'm losing grasp of it. Here's my final concern / question mark. Not only I think is Apocalypse a really boring character, what a boring portrayal from Oscar Isaac. I mean, this is a total snooze fest of a character. I'm not compelled at all. I mean, to the least amount you can feel invested in somebody, both performance and character, this is awful.
Yeah.
The trying to do the, I don't talk, I only walk, I don't ever show any sign of emotion thing is just bland AF. It's just, I don't.
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Well, I totally, totally agree. And I think that is the, like, I mean, obviously the movie is called X-Men Apocalypse, and it's weird, right? Because on paper, anytime you cast Oscar Isaac, I'm generally going to be pretty happy because I think he's a great actor. And it's crazy, you know, even looking at the year this came out, and we talked last time, like, this is following up on Ex Machina. It's not long after Drive, which are both like great Oscar Isaac performances. So he's kind of like, he's cooking at this point, but this is such a weird casting choice. Like, and that's where I don't think it's something that he did wrong. I think that this is like a casting miss like the MCU has maybe never had. Certainly not on this level. Like, maybe they're random side characters, but like, to have a feature villain like this, especially, Kyle, because this came out in 2016, we had seen so little of Thanos, right? Apocalypse and Thanos have a lot in common in terms of the way that they're represented throughout comics history.
Right,
they're both these like big, bulky, intimidating, like kind of like philosophically interesting, like towering characters.
And think about the difference of this and the portrayal of Infinity War. I mean, holy.
And they could have kind of beat the Infinity Saga to that. Like, it's another example to me of Marvel, and maybe this is the thing, right? Like, everyone says that, what's the phrase? It's like the limitations breed the creativity. But like, he's having, like, in the MCU, they don't have the advantage of the X-Men and all of those characters. They had to bring in Thanos, which is a character that, like, at least Apocalypse, a whole generation of Marvel fans will know because he had a fairly prominent role in the X-Men 90 series. Thanos, if you're not a Marvel Comics fan and like kind of a, like, you need to be a fairly big Marvel Comics fan.
Right. Like I didn't know who it was when they first was revealed.
You wouldn't. And there's no reason why you would. And like the fact that that character is as big as he is now in the comics is even more of a representation of his role in the films. But if they had given us some version of that, like the gravitas that Brolin brings to Thanos, and like cast someone that's like
so good,
even just like more like, and again, you know, whatever you want to do with the CG mode or makeup or whatever. And I don't want to, like, I appreciate the fact that they tried the practical effects approach here and didn't heavily CGI Apocalypse. But if you're going to do that, you've got to get a big guy, like get someone that can get like Chris Hemsworth level bulky. It should not be Chris Hemsworth, but someone that like can bring that kind of.
It's not just that. That is obviously one aspect of it, but also the writing is atrocious. Like, give him some actual lines. Let him talk.
Yeah.
To where we can connect. The portrayal of only saying a few words. Like, remember when he's touching the TV and it's just like, no dialogue, no dialogue. War. No dialogue. No.
Yeah.
Weapons. No dialogue. You know, what are you talking about? Yeah. He's like, it's like they're trying to do that. He's never heard of any of this. It's still the same. It's just like, dude, it's terrible.
No, it's
and
like,
I think this is.
It also sounds like whenever Oscar Isaac is doing his like F. Murray Abraham impression, like when he's supposed to be channeling Khonshu, but it's like coming through Oscar Isaac.
Okay, so I love that you said that, because I feel like there are two things that I'm learning on this X-Men journey. It's two things that the MCU has done so elite that you can't even have a conversation with somebody if they think that these other franchises are on the same level in two categories. One, as we've talked about so many times, is just the overall narrative and connectedness, right? The game plan. DC, mm-hmm. DC, Sony, Fox did not have even Star Wars. Did not have remotely close to the game plan that Kevin did in creating a universe and keeping things going. It's not even worth talking about. It's like the minor leagues, essentially. So that's one thing that has just become painfully obvious. And I think the other thing is, look, I totally get how somebody like Oscar Isaac would get burned out from these kind of blockbusters if this is what he's doing. I mean, how defeating has it got to be to do this kind of stuff? And that's the thing. I think that is happening to a far greater degree in these other companies' superhero films. And people in the public lump them together. But this kind of burnout because of how atrocious a character is approached is not really happening in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You hear about it from Madame Web and Apocalypse.
Right.
And like it's just becoming so apparent that the MCU just doesn't really have this kind of thing happen ever.
Even Quantumania, which if people want to point to that as a failure of Marvel Studios, like I don't think that any of what people would point to is about the representation of certain characters. Like that
even if they did. You don't hear like Michael Douglas talking about it very much, about how he regrets this and it was terrible. You know what I'm saying? Like, you don't, like, I remember Kumail was so depressed at the reaction to the Eternals, but the tone was never like, I need to reevaluate my life kind of thing.
Well, and it even was, like,
man, how did people not get this? You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I think that that's a good point. And, even like Jonathan Majors, aside from like all of the controversy there, like his time immediately following Ant-Man before that, you know, which he was very much on the rise and he was very happy to have been in that movie. And all of his comments about it were positive. And like everyone's comments about his portrayal were positive. My point being like, that's the, you know, like if that is Marvel failing at something, then that failure from this perspective, like you're saying, is like on a very different level.
My point in saying that too it's he's correct and it's understandable why, going back to last week's episode, in a round table, there's an actor, maybe it's Sam Jackson or another actor not in the MCU, that is trying to lump these things together. And I love him for doing this. Oscar Isaac, I see now why he jumps in and goes, no, Moon Knight is not that. Because he's right. It's not. And I think the people that have a huge problem with Moon Knight not being more like this are just incorrect, in my opinion. I like that if Oscar Isaac's going to come back, he does put that kind of character work in, because this is what it looks like when you don't care about the character work. And it's terrible. So I love that he defended Moon Knight in the roundtable setting. And I think he's justifiably burned out by these blockbusters. Both things are true.
Yeah. And it's just it's a bummer to me, because it is a really interesting character. And there was some stuff that, again, I think that it was on the one hand, just a poor choice based on what the franchise had done to date. I also think that the same can be said for Dark Phoenix, because it introduces aliens for the first time in a way that feels really random. But, you know, again, in their defense, and maybe this is where, like, well, I would say that that's in the synopsis, but the synopsis is just apparently that they face a bigger threat.
Well, there were a couple other lines too. I didn't read it after that.
But I do, no, it's funny because I think that I saw the same thing. It queued up the same next for me. But I do, to kind of go back to how we ended Days of Future Past, also talking about how, like, I thought that would have been the perfect capper. But I also understand the appeal to what they were going for here, which was like, okay, we kind of got to do the 60s era X-Men thing with First Class. We got to do, like, the Days of Future Past storyline, which is one of the most famous X-Men storylines, and we did it so well. And then you kind of look at, okay, everything else that we've seen put to film is really, like, a heavily, like, modernized adaptation. It's much less, like, colorful, much less, like, superhero-y than we were getting even in the MCU by this time. And so I think that the instinct to say, okay, we're going to reset it, we're going to have a new timeline where, like, all of the stuff we've done is not really, like, that doesn't have to change, like, that can live on and concluded in Days of Future Past. But now we're going to have fun going back and adapting some of the stories that we've seen them adapting now in X-Men 97, from stuff in the 80s and stuff in eventually the 90s. And, you know, like, there are moments here where, like, I see why they decided to do that and how it is fun. Like, when you see Scott finally put his, like, you know, blue costume with the yellow, like, strap across the chest. Like, there are little, like, okay, yeah, we have never gotten this version of the X-Men. That is the version of the X-Men that I would still love to get if we get the MCU film. And I get, like, okay, we've breathed new life into the franchise. Let's try it. But then the other question for me, and again, this is, like, mostly a positive comment because I do think that there are some cool things there. But then, like, why marry yourself to the decades formula if you're not going to actually operate by those rules? Like, it's so weird. I had to double check this. And in case people don't realize, and they're like, this is an in-movie confirmed thing by various dates. First Class is 1963. Days of Future Past is 1973. And this is 1983. And nobody has aged at all in any way. And it's supposed to have been 20 years, but it's only been, you know, 5 years since they filmed First Class. So, of course, the actors wouldn't have aged. And there are some people like Mystique where you can buy it. And, you know, at least Magneto, they give him a beard. And so it's like there's something there.
He's skinnier, but what, too, it looks like.
But it's just like, it's so strange to me. Like, Charles makes the comment when he first sees Moira through Cerebro, like, she's barely aged a day. And it's like, yeah, no kidding. It's just a weird, like, again, to your point, I was reading the other day in that MCU timeline book that I was talking about on the main feed recently, like Feige reiterates the fact that he did not, like, he's known for having this grand plan, but he didn't have that grand plan when they made Iron Man. Like, he just wanted to tell an Iron Man story and hope that that would be the best it could be and eventually allow for them to bring in other Avengers and maybe even an Avengers movie. And I think by the time they got to the Avengers is when you see them actually say, okay, like, this is working. Let's, like, map this out for real and see kind of how far we can go. And, like, the difference here is, like, sure, it's like, they did not know when they made the first X-Men or even the second X-Men really what was available, and they didn't really have the concept of a universe that exists in the way that the MCU does. And so I'll give them that. But by this point, you, like, have a perfect kind of in-game moment, and I'm like, you gotta, you know, it's sort of your responsibility now, if you're gonna shepherd this franchise, to think at least one step ahead. And it's just strange to me that there seems to be no thought given to that kind of thing. And I want to get into, like, the nitty gritty, because I'm with you, and that there were a lot of kind of delightful things about this movie that I enjoyed. Well, I was never bored. But I just want to say, like, the entire premise of it, of like this younger X-Men series, it feels confused to me.
Well, it totally does. By the way, I love when a rant like what happened from you and I just a few seconds ago happens, because, like, I totally thought I was going to come into today's episode kind of sleepwalking through it, because the movie was fine, but I'm not that passionate about it. And then I hear myself get this worked up like I did a second ago, and I'm like, good, I'm feeling something good. Like I care, obviously. Like, that's the whole point. I'm not here just to trash it, just to trash it. I am so confused at all the things you just said too, because I'm like, I wish it was different, or I wish someone had that foresight. I do feel like it needs to be pointed out. It's like, yeah, I guess I'm trying to say I went into it thinking, okay, we'll see about Apocalypse. And now I'm like getting fired up about it, because I have other stuff, not just the aging. Okay. This version of Mystique and Jennifer Lawrence suck.
Bad. It sucks.
I mean, I don't like her at any part of it. The kicker, again, because of the power levels thing, there are times where I want some of the mutants just to go, you know what? I'll see myself out. This one's not for me. Like, like when you see Magneto fighting Apocalypse, I kind of want somebody like Mystique to go, you know what? I'm out. Like, this, or like Angel, I just can't really offer much here. Or remember the Hedgehog guy? Like, if he's there, it's time to not suit up for the X-Men, you know, kind of thing. Like, this is the adults talking right now. But the kicker for me is Jennifer Lawrence sucks. It looks stupid. The character sucks. I don't understand the character's motivations all the time.
Dude.
And then you get to the very end, and this is my favorite thing. The very last shot of her now fully bought in training, going, quote, forget everything you know.
None of that
matters. Dun, 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 X-Men. I'm like,
dude,
shut your mouth, Mystique. Like, you weren't a part of this. Like,
that scene is one of the worst things I've, again, until, like, whenever they show the X-Men and it feels very, you know, uncanny X-Men from the 70s and 80s with the costumes, and that's all cool. But, like, the fact that, oh, man, I hate it so much. Like, it makes so much more sense. Like, that's supposed to be Professor X. And maybe that does, you know, you don't want to see him in that way, because that feels like a kind of
everything, you know.
Oh, man, it's I think the Jennifer Lawrence of it all is one of the biggest mistakes that this entire franchise made, not because she's so bad, but because
she might not be bad in everything. She's bad in all these X-Men films.
I think she is
the worst
by far in this one. I think she's just a little bit better in First Class. And then I think she's best in Days of Future Past.
Still not great, but yes, correct.
No, agreed. But, like, I think the bigger problem, aside from just how much she, like, it would not, It would not be a huge problem
aside
if Mystique
from the hairline.
Was so bad.
Yes.
Like, think about this. Like, Rebecca Romijn's Mystique in the original trilogy is like, I think she does a great job. Like, it's not, yep. It's not like something to write home about, but it kind of doesn't have to be because the character's role
right.
is not right. like, we don't need that from her.
That's what Annika kept saying. Why do we have to keep centering everything on her?
It's because
why is
Jennifer
the character
Lawrence,
such a big deal?
She was having such a moment in the mid-2000s or mid-2010s that like she, because I didn't realize this, First Class actually preceded The Hunger Games. And like that was really like, I always had it in my mind that The Hunger Games was like her first big thing.
For sure.
But it was First Class that like launched it. And then I think by the time they got to Days of Future Past, she was already a huge deal. I mean, she was like holding down an entire other franchise. And then here it's like, well, we can't lose who is probably the most famous person in this entire movie right now. Like Fassbender.
But instead they keep
that.
Leaning McAvoy, into it. They go further and further.
But it's also so weird, like arc wise, like I can't, like it's one of the reasons why I think if they were going to make another movie and if they were going to try to like keep some of these characters in any way, you have like, don't make it something that's supposed to be like, again, according to the filmmakers, a conclusion to a trilogy, because you're having to create new arcs out of nothing and then wrap them all up in one movie. And that's inherently unsatisfactory. Like we saw the characters come to a place in Days of Future Past that kind of made sense. Like you understand why Mystique goes from being who she was in First Class to Days of Future Past. I still don't like watching it, but I at least understand where she's ending. And I like the fact that she's like looking like Mystique does in the originals and like operating that way and the fighting style, like, but then to bring her back to the point of, oh, now she doesn't want to show her true form anymore because like even around other mutants, because it's just some like act of defiance, is so weird. And I don't like the constant back and forth between like, is she like, her and Hank's conversations drive me crazy. Because I'm like, I don't know what either of you ever represent. Like, are you for, like embracing your true self? Are you not? Who's trying to get who to do what? Do you
and
like
every
each other?
Every single time she walks in, she clarifies the Beast. Every time. Like, oh, you're not blue. What went wrong? Right. I'm like, oh my gosh. Weren't you the one that asked them for the serum originally?
It's like, it's all, and even it's like, and I was thinking about this and trying to decide whether this movie was supposed to be viewed in any way, like as a follow-up to the Rogue Cut version versus just the theatrical. And, you know, I think technically I'm sure just the theatrical, but I also wonder from the filmmaker's perspective, like with a scene like when she comes back in, and he's like, I never thought I'd see you walk through these doors again. And I feel like he said the exact same thing in the Days of Future Past Rogue Cut. So they're either doing like a callback to a scene that they know a lot of people haven't seen, or more likely they're repurposing that scene a little bit. But either way, it's like, man, has anyone ever cared about this relationship? Like even the people in our friends from work community that have been watching along with us, the folks that were like really on board with the Rogue Cut, I think the one thing everybody could agree with was that like that scene with her and Beast was like a malignant tumor on that movie. And I just don't like that's also why like the whole First Class thing is harder for me, and it's why I maybe grade that movie a little bit more harshly than I should, is I don't really like any of what it introduces except for the Xavier Magneto dynamic, like,
which
and we've talked about that.
Again, not special at all here, but one of the few redeeming qualities of the film, right?
Right.
Again. Like, I think that McAvoy is pretty good here. At least he's parallel to what he did in Days of Future Past. Magneto's not as much of a focus and not as cool as, like, if Days of Future Past is his, you know, his magnus opus as a character.
Right.
He's less involved. But again, I'm like, okay, I appreciate Fassbender. I like whenever their dynamic comes down to them saying, like, see you later, old friend kind of thing. Like, I thought.
Yeah.
Like, every time it comes back to that, I'm like, yeah, this is the driving relationship of this entire reboot. It's trying to be the, you know, Cap and Tony thing. It's not to that degree at all, but I do like them. And I do think Fassbender should be Magneto in the MCU when it happens still.
Yeah. No, I agree with that. But I think that I was also a little, I was disappointed not with his performance, but with, like, it's so weird. Simon Kinberg is becoming such an enigma to me because it's not as though any of his writing is ever, like, great to me per se, but, like, there are times when it's not bad. Like Days of Future Past is not a poorly written movie, but it's like, then there's he is credited as the sole screenwriter on that movie. Then after Days of Future Past, he's the screenwriter on the Fantastic Four movie from 2015, which I still haven't seen, but we all kind of know how that turned out. Then he comes back and writes this movie, which I think is really poorly written. Like, and which is what makes me think about this, because, like, the Magneto lines that I feel like Fassbender still delivers with as much gravitas as he possibly can are just worse. Like,
can you think of an example off the top of your head?
I mean, like, some of the stuff that's just kind of weird to me, like the my babies line when his wife and daughter die, is just, like, kind of weird. Like, I don't, like, I just, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it, but it doesn't, like, yeah.
Do you think he's also making plot decisions with that writing, or just mainly the dialogue? Like, did he write that Magneto is going to have a family and lose them? Or is that a Singer thing, you think?
See, I think that's a good question, because, like, looking back at Days of Future Past, there are several folks that have story credits there, but he's the only one with the screenplay credit. Looking at Apocalypse Now, yeah, again, there are several folks with story credits. So I think that's probably... It seems like the way he works, looking across a lot of the movies he's worked on, is that he's the screenplay guy, but he will work with the other filmmakers in developing the story.
I found that whole part of Magneto's story to also be too much, a step too far. I literally wrote down, oh no, Magneto's going to be put through more trauma, isn't he? Like, I feel like at this point, there would be no talking Magneto off a ledge to come back to Charles's side. Because all he's ever been at this point has been right, right, right. And he tries to do the other thing and gets proven wrong over and over. And he finally, like, gets stopped in Days of Future Past. But now it's happening again to him, where really a guy lets go of one arrow that goes right through both of them in their chest. And I just am like, do we need, like, okay, hear me out on this. Don't you think there could have been a more compelling Magneto if he didn't lose his family, but somehow was still brought in by Apocalypse to the whole mess? And then at the end, when he's involved with Apocalypse, the line being like, think of your wife and your daughter, and that kind of being the thing to pull him back to do the right thing. Couldn't that have been more motivating than once again he loses his family?
Right. Because now he's like invested, you know?
Right. And then the selling point to get him to come back is, again, that your family is Charles and me, Raven. And I'm like, I don't know that it is at this point, really. Like, his family was the one that just got murdered by a rogue arrow. I don't know. I don't like it either. No, I think it's just a step too far again for me.
And it also feels, it's so clunky because it's like, you know, really, as soon as those characters are introduced, where we're heading. Like, it's okay. We have now given him in the opening scenes of this movie a wife and child that he loves, that he's perfectly like gentle towards, and he's doing everything exactly right. And he's going to lose both of them and then be, you know, harrowed and turned back to Magneto. And it's like, I don't like, if I can forecast exactly what's coming, like from the moment I see the characters introduced, like that's not the right route. And that's like, I don't, it's very much the, like the kind of.
Right. Him keeping his wife and daughter would have been more surprising.
Exactly. And it's just like, I think anytime you do that, it can be done really, it can be done well. And there's a reason why it's a trope to have someone kind of avenge a person. But
yeah, but they did that well in First Class already. That's my point. We already had that and it was great.
Yeah. Oh man. Although like, geez, I just thinking about the Avenge and First Class and the whole like team suit up thing when they're on the plane and she's like telling the story about Havoc. That was another moment where I was just like groaning because she's like, oh yeah, we used to be a team. We called ourselves the X-Men. We used to call Alex Havoc. And I'm like, no, you didn't. You all just like had like a party one night and decided what all of your like made up super person names were. And then you like, this entire, like, that's what I'm saying. All of the threads that this follows up on, none of it is worth it. Like, I think that there's a world where like they could have just actually utilized the fresh start. And it's so weird that like, Bryan Singer, especially, like he should know better at this point. He's seen what happened to this franchise.
We're looking at you, Brian. I'm looking at you.
Who else? Like, if not you, then who? And the reason I brought up the Simon, like, yeah, because there isn't a Feige, but it should be him. He's been doing this longer than Feige. Like
that, but that's what's mind blowing that he finally got his reboot and his first step is this. This is the direction you thought it should go. You had it nailed in Days of Future Past. That movie is a banger. It slaps. And then with your first move, this is what we're doing, Brian.
Like,
please
introduce a new, like, make an Iron Man of the X-Men, you know, like give us a new long form story and let it start. Like there's no reason why we had to go to Apocalypse so quickly. Like we ended, like the nice thing about Days of Future Past, I thought, is that the threat to the 70s X-Men, like if you take the like end times part out of it, was fairly straightforward and fairly small scale.
Minute.
Like,
yeah,
it was.
It's maybe in 50 years we'll be in trouble, you know.
Right, and that's the like that's the real I think genius of that, like that
Agreed.
Setup is
Agreed.
You feel the stakes because you see down the line what it turns into, but you don't have a world that's like being borderline ripped apart, like and so they could have proceeded from just that like. That moment, which one of the positive things about this movie, I thought, is how much they make that moment the like key timeline shifter. Like the fact that like Apocalypse wakes up because like everyone finds out about the X-Men in this very public way in 1973. And then these like acolytes revive this kind of old religion sort of thing that's based on the original mutant, and that results in him waking up. And like, I like that
Raven's a hero and Magneto is, you know, in hiding. Yeah.
Right. Like it's all like, I think that they could have picked up with something where they're doing the same, like, okay, this had the impact. Like we're going to operate off of like, now the world knows the X-Men exist. And again, yeah, now tell some like classic Chris Claremont X-Men adventure stories, but start with like a villain that is more akin to what the original X-Men trilogy started with Magneto. Like, give us a villain that is not trying to destroy the world. Like, that's the, we've talked about that forever as the worst place to go, really ever, I think, but especially if this is supposed to be kind of the first step out. And that's why I started this with the like, is this the end of the trilogy? Is this the first thing after the end of a series? Like, because I don't think that this movie, I don't think it knows what it wants. And I think that it's as much, talking about films that came out in 2016, as much a victim of the MCU's like success as DC is, in that, you know, I think had DC, like we've always said, not rushed to get the Justice League out there, then maybe it would have been a different story and we would still have that ongoing universe. But in, by skipping a bunch of steps, it just becomes this like gobbledygook. And that's what we have here. Like, we don't have to compete with the massive finale for the MCU that, you know, is just around the corner. Like, just do your own thing. Like, the thing that you know how to do well. And I don't know. It's like there is consternation from me.
All right, we got to wrap. Here's what I'll say. I appreciate John Ottman's attempt to bring the X-Men into a modern sounding score like he did with Days of Future Past and here. And I appreciate him bringing back some of those themes and including the original theme. Finally, thank you again, John Ottman. I did think that it was fun to see Jubilee. Now that I know who Jubilee is as a character, you never even see fireworks here, but I'm guessing that's who they're trying to portray with that, right?
Yeah.
So that's cool. Oh my gosh, Olivia Munn's outfit is the unbelievable. The worst outfit I've ever seen. Please, dude, go look at Olivia Munn's.
In general. In this movie is so like really bad to me.
Ex-girlfriend of Aaron Rodgers.
Man, she was in a Marvel movie as well at some point. I feel like she like had some random role early on, but I
thought the nuke scene was actually pretty cool. I think Quicksilver is dope. It was fun to see Stryker show up and go to the dam. I thought was kind of a fun tie-in.
Yeah.
It looks bad. There's actually CGI issues. And I, again, didn't fully buy Dark Phoenix's moment as much as it could have been. I thought in general, Sophie Turner, I thought she was very good. Pretty much just walked through the movie. And then I did like Charles trying to get like Jean's attention and all that, but I don't love the trump card move. That's my thought.
I kind of liked more than I remembered. I kind of liked young Scott. I thought that was actually well handled.
It was pretty good. It wasn't great. Yeah. I'm eating Lucky Charms, by the way.
Oh, nice. Like, I could just see, like, I thought that it was a good, like, I don't really think that I saw the like, OG Gene in Sophie Turner's performance here, whereas I can see James Marsden's in the performance here. Which, what is that guy's name? He's the guy from Ready Player One. Ty Sheridan. Like, I thought he again, yeah, it was not anything that was like, you know, you're going to write home about again. But I thought that it was a nice kind of like, he's kind of a jerk. He's a little overconfident. Like, which is, you know, I kind of like when Cyclops is more than just the Boy Scout. And so that was something that I enjoyed. I also enjoyed the battle portion of the letting Wolverine loose. Like, I liked that he was wearing the like classic, like he was, this was one example of them nailing kind of comic accurate looks that was kind of fun. Like all the machinery stuff that he's wearing is straight out of the comics. I thought that like seeing him with the adamantium claws again and just like going off in a way that we haven't really seen since that one scene in X2 that I'm always bringing up, like that was all fun. And then as soon as he took the helmet off and had like that moment with Jean, I was like, I could not wait for the scene to be over. Like I was like, I thought like that was really bad. Like the way that Hugh Jackman's like hair is where they're like giving him the like mullet thing. And also like his moment with Sophie Turner, like I get what they were trying to do, but it should have been a thing where he just like escaped. Like I don't think we needed the like heart wrenching moment, but otherwise kind of a fun Wolverine shout out.
Here's what I find fascinating. When we started this journey, I remember being blown away that X-Men 1 was pretty cool. And then X2 coming on here going, oh my gosh, this is great. How did I not know about this? And then what did I say? I said, I'm excited to see what happens because the fact that I don't know about this means something went awry. And we haven't even watched New Mutants or Dark Phoenix yet. Now I get it. I get it. I understand when you combine everything we've talked about with the cultural factors, how this could just, we've fallen off a cliff at this point. Not just because this movie is so bad. And in my ranking, I thought I would still probably put this ahead of X3 in Origins. So I'd probably go X2, X1, First Class, The Wolverine, then Apocalypse, then X3 in Origins. So it's not just this movie's fault, but now when you kind of fast forward and you look at all of the factors of where they have gone since X2, it makes sense how this has gone into oblivion and needs saving from the MCU. Kevin Feige needs to save the X-Men franchise because just weird decision after weird decision that started with X3 being a terrible film relative to what that original trilogy was trying to do. Then the decision to go back and reboot in the 60s and missing some stuff, but then kind of salvaging it with Days of Future Past and then, you know, kind of ignoring the fact that there's these middle entries that are like mostly not perfect. And then Days of Future Past saves it. And then you're finally, okay, I'm a little bit bought back in. They have me again. I'll give them one more chance to get this going again. And this is the follow-up. It's like, there's no hope for this. This is irreparably broken.
Yeah.
It needs a full reboot, which is why I still don't think, I still don't think there's any, I don't think, I love that one. I don't think there's any version of any of this that I need in the MCU. Again, the lone exception being if you want a cameo shout out to Logan in Secret Wars or something of just what he has gone through in this universe, or if you want to have Hugh Jackman or Michael Fassbender play their characters, I still just don't think you need to pick up from any of this. You can just tell me it's a different Michael Fassbender. It's an alternate version of Magneto. Give me some backstory. My point is I'm ready for a total clean slate at this point.
You know, it's funny because I think back to the conversation we had and man, I never get a chance to go back and listen to old episodes unless we're revisiting a project or something. But I have this vivid memory of the episode we recorded on WandaVision after the Pietro reveal there from Evan Peters. And you and I had a long conversation about it offline. We talked about it a lot on the episode. Like, oh my gosh, are they about to like make... like bring in the X-Men legitimately in this way? And then we like debated the problems with that. And I remember at the time, the biggest thing for me was, yeah, it would just be so weird to have, like, even if you brought these people in from a different universe and they had like the backstories, it would just be strange to now like set them in a totally different timeline. And certainly it would be crazy to assume that the things that had happened in the X-Men universe had happened in the MCU. But I think what's weird now is I actually don't think, like, if they had stopped at Days of Future Past, there's a world where like that could be where Marvel picked up. Like they set the table and then Marvel comes in and takes over and there's really no baggage there and they can kind of do whatever they want to do with those characters moving forward and keep the cast members like Fassbender that work really well. But it's this movie that takes it kind of beyond the pale. Like now there's no way that you can create new believable narratives with these characters that have like been possessed by like an evil ancient Egyptian mutant and almost destroyed the world in various ways. And then now they're going to what, like have a little fight? Like what's the, like, where do you go from here, I guess? And even with Dark Phoenix, which is maybe where we should leave off, I guess, like I'm thinking, what on earth? Like this, if the final scenes here between Charles and Magneto, like there's a part of me that was like, I feel like Fassbender comes back for Dark Phoenix, but I cannot imagine how that would make sense. And then, you know, lo and behold, like on the Disney Plus art, it's like Fassbender's right kind of front and center, of course. And it's like, how many times are we going to do this? Like, so I'm with you. I think I would rank this in the same spot also. There's a part of me that would, I think it's maybe, it's definitely a worse movie than The Wolverine for sure. I think that there are some things about it that I like some very X-Men feeling things, but it's definitely better than Simon Kinberg's other terrible movie, which was X3. I just thought it was funny that like we get that line from him in the movie where they, after they go see Return of the Jedi, and Scott's like, or Gene's like, at least we can agree the third one is always the worst. And at first I was like, oh, that's funny. That's Bryan Singer like messing with Brett Ratner. And then I realized like, no, that's Simon Kinberg messing with Simon Kinberg. Like he wrote both of those movies. And then he's going, like he's writing this movie like with a kind of cheekiness that would typically be reserved for a movie that is good. And then he's going to move to the next movie and write and direct Dark Phoenix. And that's where I'm just like, it's crazy to me where we wind up and how much control they gave this one guy over the entire X franchise. And, you know, I guess next up we get to kind of see exactly what it looks like when he gets the director's chair too.
Yeah, it's not that this movie is so bad. It's what this movie signifies that is pretty bad. We love all of you guys. We'll see you next time talking about Dark Phoenix. Right back here on Friends From Work.